From sprains to fractures, get expert care quickly at the University of Kansas Health System. Walk-in orthopedic care is open weekdays, 8 a.m. to 7 p.m., and Saturdays, 8 to 2, at I-435 and Null. Learn more at kansashealthsystem.com/orthopedics.
This is Almost Entirely Sports with Joshua Briscoe.
What else do you listen to while on a police chase, if not Almost Entirely Sports?
On Sports Radio 810 WHB.
Run.
A small bit of housekeeping from last hour. I should have just checked with Chief Bearcat on Twitter much earlier. He tweeted earlier today about those not likely to be earned guarantees for Sammy Watkins and how all that math comes together. So it does look like most of that would roll over into being a 2021 problem, which is a little bit interesting given how the rest of these deals have been structured. But it does spread out some of the risk of Sammy Watkins over a couple of years. But a hefty price they continue to pay him. That $7 million dead cap hit Bearcat described as an accounting trick that the NFL uses, which I found to be helpful terminology as we continue to try to do all of the math around what Sammy Watkins' deal will look like this year and then in some ways beyond for the Kansas City Chiefs. I probably should have just seen if we could have gotten Dan Wallach on an hour earlier just to see if he could help us do math. The good news is he's on with us now. You can follow him on Twitter, at Wallach Legal, for any number of your sports law questions. We'll talk gambling, we'll talk CBA, we'll talk coronavirus. But Dan, first and foremost, would you consider yourself to be good at math?
Definitely the stronger between verbal and math. Definitely better at math, but I'm certainly not an MIT quality person. I ended it at algebra, I think, or geometry. Yeah. So it depends. If we're talking about the NFL math, that's definitely a little fuzzy, even to them. Yes. I don't even think the NFL Players Association can do math right, because it just seemed like everyone that ever played a game of football was able to vote on this collective bargaining agreement. And that's something I've been harping on a lot. Anyway, nice to join you again, Josh. Last time we spoke, it was in person on Radio Row about a year and a half ago. So thanks for having me back on.
Absolutely. It's good to talk to you again. And it was a bummer not to get to see you in Miami, but glad to catch up with you now. Because, yes, there is very little going on in terms of on-the-field sports, but off-the-field sports conversations have been really, really busy for a while now. I do want to dig into some of that CBA stuff in just a second, but as we've been in these last few weeks, especially the last month, really, in terms of how the sports world, and really the world in general, has been dealing with coronavirus and what has been shut down and what has been postponed and what's been put in holding patterns and all of that, within the things that have happened and more things that haven't happened, what strikes you as being something that maybe most people haven't caught on to or don't spend enough time talking about that you would consider to be important?
Well, I think the thing that's now coming into light much more recently is that the decisions as to when the games are going to be rescheduled or played and how they're going to be played, the leagues are no longer in control of that decision making. They will have to give way to state and local authorities. If counties and states aren't prepared to give the clearance, the NBA and the NFL aren't going to be able to proceed. And we're seeing this with the NFL's draft preparations. I think it is just absolute insanity. I know we all want to watch the draft and have something to do April 23rd through April 25th, but I think it's tone deaf. And as Adam Schefter, aptly put it in an interview on ESPN, I mean, this is taking place while there's carnage in the streets. And the NFL wants to be able to create rules that allow the teams to have these off-site draft war rooms. And that's just not going to work, because local laws are going to preempt any NFL, policymaking. So the scheduling of a draft, the staging of a draft is really complicated, because it requires the involvement of, probably several thousand workers, all the different teams, television networks, radio networks. This is not just simply signing a free agent and having a telephone negotiation with the lawyer. This is a national event that will put thousands of people or potentially will involve thousands of people having to work. And I'm not confident that all of those people are going to be working from their homes. So it does create an added layer of risk for those people who are participating in the conduct of the draft. And I think that's reckless, especially when you consider that the season doesn't begin until September. There's plenty of time to conduct a draft. You could take this and reevaluate it every 30 days. Because it doesn't seem like the season is going to start on time. And even if it did, a draft in late May would still work.
Well, and you used a specific word in there that I've learned just enough for my ears to perk up whenever you say reckless, because recklessness is a word that, again, I've learned just enough to know that's a lawyerly word snuck in there that we can all use. If you sure. do consider the threat of recklessness in the NFL's continuing through the NFL draft and trying to put on mm-hmm. these big productions with lots of people involved, what all would that open the NFL up to? And then how is the NFL, or maybe what is the NFL getting in terms of advice from their lawyers and everything to say, you know what, we think we can still do this?
Well, I think the NFL is always going to do what it wants to do. It doesn't get out in front of issues like the NBA does. It was last to the table on sports betting. It fought to the bitter end on concussions. And even on the coronavirus today, the NFL still is operating under the hope that everything is going to kind of return to normal soon enough. I don't know what kind of advice the league is getting, but you're right. Reckless is a very specific legal term. I did not mean it in a legal sense, because certainly on the continuum of reckless and careless actions, reckless is certainly worse than negligent. What I'm saying is that probably what I mean to say is that it's irresponsible, and certainly the legal liability that the league could potentially face if anyone is exposed by virtue of having to come into close proximity with other workers. Who knows what level of social distancing works anymore? We're hearing 6 feet, now 25 feet. But needless to say, this draft is not going to be able to be conducted, from silos. People are going to be going to work. You're going to be going to work. People are going to be covering this somewhere, writing about it. Folks at home, fans, are going to want to watch it with friends of theirs and have – I've never gone to a draft party, but it just seems like the kind of event that would encourage people to watch together. And I don't think the league should be party to anything like that when we don't know how much worse this is going to get. And having a slight delay or a slight pause on this with a reevaluation every 15 days or every 30 days, there's no downside to it.
Yes, the 15 days or 30-day window, I mean, if it doesn't – and here's the thing. They're not trying to get ahead of it at this point, right? If it doesn't get better – I guess there's a fear of another thing being kicked down the league calendar, but if that happens, everything's going to continue moving by huge steps. I mean, you mentioned the NFL, kind of the tone they've had these last few days about their expectations, and they're planning as if everything is going to happen according to plan. I'm sure they've been making contingency plans for if it does get moved back at all, but they haven't said any of those things publicly. So whenever you look at the NFL's entire posture at this point, it sounds like that's at least in some ways concerning to you. Is that fair?
It's very concerning because people are dying, thousands of cases, new cases every day. This is expanding within cities and to new cities. And if you look at the multiplier involved of the number of cases, in February and how it's just growing steadily, by the time the NFL draft rolls around, this thing is not going to, get better. It's going to be far worse. This is not something that could be controllable within the next 2 to 3 weeks. I think the time frame for maybe getting a handle or getting on top of this and kind of overcoming the worst of it, I think is still several months away. But whether you believe me or not, or take a much more conservative view, there's no dispute over the fact that the league can have this draft at any time through and including, the summertime without throwing off their league calendar. I mean, most of these players are slotted into their rookie deals based upon where they're drafting. So I don't know how much run-up time a team needs to actually go from drafting the player to having him suiting up for a training camp. This is not rocket science. Yeah. The league does not need a 6-month run-up for this, or a 9-month or a 5-month run-up. The other leagues also have drafts and have their seasons starting in October and November. And I don't think the NBA or NHL are going to go forward with their drafts in late June. So why on earth is the NFL forcing this issue as this virus gets progressively worse? People are staying home. They're scared. I know as football fans, I want to see which players my team will draft, but that seems to be a subservient or subsidiary concern to the overall public health, welfare, and just the message that you're sending to your fans and customers and the risks associated with placing all of these potential employees and participants in the draft at a greater risk of exposure.
Let's go down the line a little bit, and maybe it's a little less far down the line in the NBA's specifics, but if you want to go to the NFL season, I think both of them will have some similar questions here. We're not in a place where we're likely to have a vaccine for coronavirus anytime soon.
That's about my figure.
There may be...
I
do not want to ask you to play medical doctor. I will trust you in legal
doctor.
Matters. I do not mean to ask you. Say that again.
I'm a juris doctor, right? JD.
Right.
Not an MD.
Right. Not an MD. Yeah, I'll let you keep the JD and won't ask you to play MD. But let's say with you know me being I'm a TD, I'm a Twitter doctor, and it's an absolutely worthless degree, but I'm just on Twitter all the time, and so with the information of unlikely to have a vaccine for COVID-19 by the time that seasons would like to get going again, but maybe let's say we have more accessible testing. I guess testing has always been accessible if you're the NBA, but that's neither here nor there, I suppose. What would you be looking for if you were in an advisory role to any of these leagues? And we're talking about the NBA trying to get, you know, a little bit of a warm-up and then get into the playoffs. Maybe you look back to the NCAA trying to get March Madness to happen. Obviously, it doesn't. The NFL or college football trying to get their seasons to happen on time or soon. Major League Baseball trying to begin things. Again, I'm not asking you at all to predict how that ends up going, but what would you be looking for in terms of assurances or planning if you're helping one of those leagues?
Well, I mean, the legal liability and legal risk is certainly out there, but much more importantly, the overall important, the key issue that the leagues are going to have to address. And when they act in self-interest, because it's in everyone's interest, the players and the owners, to have these games take place, because that's how they make money. That's how the stadiums are kept full. That's how the betting revenues come in for some of the sports books and the casinos, and the players face the prospect of, you know, losing, you know, all their income if the seasons are canceled. So it begins from a premise that everyone that is in position to move forward is self-interested in the name of the almighty buck. So I think it's going to take real strong leadership for a commissioner to make the right decision based upon the health and safety as the paramount issue. And if there's any risk involved, then there's always going to be some level of uncertainty and risk until we know more about how controlled this virus is. But I just don't see how we can play games at any point within the next 6 months, even with empty stadiums and empty arenas. The players are going to have to be in proximity with one another. And if we look back a few weeks, I mean, with the New Jersey Nets, they had 4 diagnosed cases. The Utah Jazz had 2. That's a very high percentage on teams that only have a 15 or 12-man roster. So I think we're a long ways away from getting the kind of assurance and clearance. And I'm not sure that the leagues are going to be best equipped to make those decisions because they want the games to take place. So I trust someone like Adam Silver. I trust someone like Rob Manfred. I don't know that I trust the National Football League to make a decision that's in the best interest of the public and the safety of their players. That's the only concern that matters. It's the one and only issue that they should be thinking about, because if economics enter into it and the league and the players you know, move this thing too aggressively. One diagnosed case, one player getting exposed has the potential to, you know, infect everyone else he comes into contact with within the context of a game, even in an empty stadium. So I don't think an empty arena solves all the problems. That limits, I think, the potential exposure, but it doesn't eliminate the risk to the players. And they have a very short time to apply their trade. And this disease, this virus is killing folks. I mean, you know, we're not reading as much about 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds dropping dead from it, but there are younger people that I'm reading about dying from the coronavirus. So this is like serious business, and to be talking about playing games in April or thinking about playing games in April is just, for me, it's beyond the pale. I think the leagues have to take their cue from, you know, state governments, counties, whoever is making the decision on what's essential work and what's essential travel. Ultimately, these calls are going to be made by federal and state governmental agencies and not by private businesses.
Does that get even more complicated when you look at college football? I mean, with the insistence the NCAA has held for so long with amateurism, does that get harder for them?
No, but I want to get back to one point. Given that the NFL teams are, you know, 32 teams in 32 different cities, all it takes is one state or one county.
Yeah.
That say, well, we don't think we're out of the woods yet. You can't have a league, you can't have a season unless all 32 teams are playing in states where the state agencies and the counties allow this kind of, you know, non-essential work to go forward. I think there's a, you know, given the patchwork of different state authorities involved, I think we're a long way away from having, 32 teams being able to move forward. Now, college sports, I think it's in the same boat. We likely will not see college games being played. I can't imagine that college football will take place before NFL football or at the same, you know, this is all going to be pushed back. Again, I'm not a doctor, but we're sitting here
in the
month of April, a few months from the beginning of the season, and you and I are both, you know, seeing what's taking place. It's getting significantly worse. So I think it's just, mind-boggling to me that there's any consideration at this point about a particular startup date for the resumption of league play. It's just nothing that is even, you know, remotely possible at this juncture.
We're talking to Daniel Wallach. You can follow him on Twitter at Wallach Legal, W-A-L-L-A-C-H Legal on Twitter for all sorts of stuff about sports, gambling, gaming law.
It kind of got out of my wheelhouse a little bit. This is the first time, you know, in all the years that I've been going on the radio and writing about legal issues in sports. I mean, a pandemic. I think this is new for all of us, and we're still trying to figure it out.
No, it is, and it's why I appreciate also being able to talk to you about the things you see differently, right? Like I'm, you know, again. And no interest, and don't want anyone listening now to hear either of us as medical professionals, which we are not. But I think your perspective is important there because you will latch on the different things than most of us. But I do also want to talk to you about the CBA, something a little bit more back in the on-field world, assuming that it eventually ends up coming around. You've tweeted about the CBA a bunch. You and I chatted a little bit about it and some things that you've really caught on to as far as the NFL CBA that passed. You mentioned at the beginning of our conversation here the fact that just about everybody who's ever thrown a football was allowed to vote in this thing. What are a few of the things that jump out to you in the way that all of this went down?
I'm being facetious about that. I think there was surprise out of a lot of corners by virtue of the fact that more than 500 NFLPA members didn't even bother to vote. I think there were 2,500 eligible voters. 20% of those eligible voters didn't even care enough to vote, which highlights for me two important points. One, how do you get 2,500 eligible voters when you have 32 NFL teams? That works out to almost 80 players per team. I understand that active rosters have 53. There are an additional 10 on the practice squad, maybe another 5 to 7 who finish the season on injured reserve. But that only brings you up to about 70. So there are like hundreds of votes out there being cast by individuals who may not have even played in the NFL last year. And the membership criteria for being in the NFL Players Association is that you're either on a roster, you're under contract, or this amorphous, you know, catch-all provision of actively seeking employment as a professional football player. I mean, God, you could have played 5 years ago for the Kansas City Chiefs or been a practice squad player 3 years ago and not be giving up your dream of being a football player. And as long as you're paying your dues, you have the right to vote on a collective bargaining agreement, which is just absolutely stunning to me. And when you consider how the NFL, how this new CBA really helps the middle class and the bottom of a roster by creating additional practice squad slots and an expanded roster, that if you're someone who's on the outside looking in and you're not a starting player and maybe you're not even on a team right now, I think you would be much more inclined to vote for a CBA that is going to increase the possibilities for, you know, for getting you know, signed by an NFL team. And there were just too many of those folks among the eligible voters. I mean, out of the 80 per team, you only have about 22 starters, 11 offense, 11 defense, you know, place kicker, punter, maybe a long snapper. But once you get past those original 24, 25, that still leaves 50 that are either backups or players that aren't on teams right now. So given how this collective bargaining agreement was negotiated to appeal to those who are sort of at the bottom of the roster, it wasn't a surprise to me that the CBA passed, albeit narrowly, because there were just too many. The class of eligible voters was so large that, you know, the Aaron Rodgers of the world or Tom Brady, they weren't the ones that were sort of the, you know, representative sample of the average voter. The average voter might very well have just been a practice squad player or someone who's been out of the league for a couple of years. And I think that's a situation that needs to be looked at a lot more closely and potentially even scrutinized or questioned by a lawyer or by a player who doesn't think the CBA should have passed. I think there could be something to it that, you know, why are 80 players per team eligible to vote? And, you know, listen, I don't doubt the results of the vote, but I think the voting criteria is something that it may not be on the up and up here. I believe the way that the NFLPA's constitution is written, it really only allows players on rosters or under contract with the team to be able to vote. It shouldn't permit or doesn't permit those who are actively seeking employment to vote on something as important as a CBA that affects the rights of current players.
But so I asked this from a place of genuine ignorance. Does that cross up at all with what Eric Reed is asking in terms of what he's looking at in the CBA not being fully up and up?
It's not the same issue, but he's arguing a different issue that the CBA draft that the players voted on has different language than the CBA, which has now taken effect, that there were some changes made to the disability provisions that could potentially affect thousands of former players, and that those that changed language was only added to the CBA after the players voted. So Eric Reed and his legal team, at this point, they haven't brought a lawsuit. They haven't filed a labor grievance or commenced an action before the National Labor Relations Board. But right now, they've sent out a demand letter asking the, you know, Dee Smith and the NFLPA to conduct a revote. And you can predict what the answer is going to be there. I mean, that's not going to happen. I mean, from the NFL's perspective, whatever happened with the NFLPA, whether the language was changed and the NFLPA didn't notify their membership about any change language, that's on the union. That's not on the NFL. And if Dee Smith wanted to conduct a new vote. I don't think he'd be able to legally accomplish that because the issue was not the fault of the NFL. It was the fault of the union for not properly communicating those changes. But I certainly think that there's a possibility that this could go into an NLRB proceeding or possibly a lawsuit. But the new CBA has already taken effect. I don't know if you can unscramble the egg. The difficulty with signing a deal like this so far before the expiration of the old deal is that they included language that made it take effect right away without having to wait until next year for the new CBA to begin. They put it into effect a year before the expiration of the old deal.
Right, and obviously some of that stuff, like the new playoff format, those wheels have already begun turning. What do you make of the contents of the new CBA, what the players did and didn't get, and what you found interesting in terms of what you thought they might be asking for or ultimately didn't ask for or did ask for, didn't get, et cetera?
Well, Josh, as someone who's lived through Deflategate, the Ezekiel Elliott case and Adrian Peterson legal case, there have been historically a disconnect between the league and the union on the issue of player discipline. And after each one of these battles, the flaws in the league's procedures would get exposed in every case. We learn that, you know, players who are accused of violating the personal conduct policy aren't necessarily getting a fair hearing. They're in front of a partial arbitrator. No ability to cross-examine witnesses or gain access to evidence. And I was led to believe, as we all were, that this was such an important issue to the players that it would be something that they would want to address in the new CBA. And the new CBA doesn't make any meaningful change to the NFL's disciplinary structure. There is a neutral arbitrator for initial determinations of personal conduct policy violations, but in each and every case, the commissioner is the final arbiter. So any and all appeals of player discipline under Article 46 go to the commissioner. More problematic is the threshold of evidence needed to sustain a violation. If you or I are indicted for a crime, the jury would have to convict us or find, the proof would have to be beyond a reasonable doubt. If it's a civil case, it's a preponderance of the evidence. The threshold of evidence in the NFL's justice system is the lowest threshold imaginable. It's credible evidence. So long as there exists any credible evidence, even if it's outweighed by other evidence, that's enough to discipline a player, sideline him for up to 6 games, potentially impact his career forever, based on the lowest threshold known in the law. So I was really surprised that the union didn't fight harder to at least raise the burden of proof that the league would have to, carry forward in order to suspend a player. That was left untouched. Goodell, as the judge, jury, and executioner, was left untouched. And pretty much the old system is the new system.
Dan, we've gone way over time, and that's that's because I've enjoyed talking to you. I promise that it will not be another year and 2 months before we talk to you again. Thank you, as always, for coming on with us.
Well, absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Josh. I just hope that there's a Super Bowl and a Radio Row next year that we can actually meet again at and do another interview. But I'm happy to come back on anytime. Thanks again.
I really appreciate it. God, think about that. Think about Radio Row right now. What an absolute petri dish that sounds like. That happened 2 months ago. We had another Radio Row. That's really strange. I cannot recommend highly enough following Dan on Twitter. Daniel Wallach. He's at Wallach Legal on Twitter for sports betting laws and everything going on in the legal side of sports. He's good to talk to. His tweets are good. His work is good. So follow him on Twitter at Wallach Legal. Whenever we come back, we'll talk about the other thing the Chiefs did today, not signing Sammy Watkins, but another addition that was a little bit less of a splash, but I actually think could work out pretty well for the Chiefs. Talk about that next.
This is Almost Entirely Sports with Joshua Briscoe.
We're going to be subscription-based from now on. The only way you're going to be able to listen is if you pay us $10 per episode. But if you share the episode to 5 different people, you get it for free.
Ooh, that is good, because I was going to say, hey, I got bad news. We're going to get $0.
But see, then we get 5 billion people watching.
because everybody had to share it to five people.
You think?
Maybe. I'm aiming high.
You know how many things
I shoot for the stars.
On Sports Radio 810 WHB.
Something else we very badly need to talk about. I've been planning on talking about all week. The Ringer has a best TV character of the century bracket they've been doing on Twitter, and they've been plowing through it. And so we don't even get to fill out a blank one. I'll just tell you right now that their final is Walter White versus Michael Scott. Have you watched Breaking Bad, Rudy?
I have.
Okay, I knew you're a big Office guy. I have seen both of these shows in their entirety. Michael Scott's an excellent character. Walter White's character development is literally, like, has to be shown in film schools.
Yeah, it's hard because they're just two very different styles of shows where not that Michael Scott's character doesn't develop in The Office, because he does. He becomes more likable, but I think that's a decent amount of that is just more of, like, society changed and some of the jokes you made in the early seasons you can't make anymore, whereas, like, a drama is built around that. Like, the progression of Walter White is the show, really. And that's kind of typically the case with dramas. Like, the main character, it's how their character progresses is whether or not it makes the show good. So that's a really, really, really tough draw for Michael Scott.
I mean, it's the championship. He's there at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Scott just beat Ron Swanson, which is a pretty good... I know.
Yeah, that's tough. For the
dramatic Office matchup, Tyrion Lannister, the one seed, lost to Dwight Schrute in the Sweet 16.
I'm good with that, actually. I think I'm good with that. Dwight's an all-time character. This probably comes down to a lot of it just, like, are you, if you're more of a sitcom or drama person, you know, that's probably what it comes down to.
The bracket's really fun. You should check it out. Eventually, we may talk about it a little bit more and look at some of, like, the upsets or what should have been upsets and all of that, because it is fun. I voted for Walter White because I just feel like that's honestly, like, I feel like he's probably the rightful winner.
I think that's probably where I would go. Like Michael Scott's more of a recency bias because I've just seen The Office more recently than Breaking Bad, but the Walter White character was truly outstanding how he developed. Really, pretty quickly in the first couple of episodes of the first season, but just how he continues to develop throughout the entire series.
The Millennials bracket had an Arya Stark Jesse Pinkman matchup in the Elite Eight. That one is brutal. BoJack Horseman is an 11 seed, way too low. Anti animation bias there. Lost to Jesse Pinkman, the 3 seed in that bracket. There's some very good matchups in here that would be good to argue about. I just don't know if we have any that we feel like we need to argue about. So we need to take a look at the bracket. Ron Swanson beat Dwight Schrute. I think that's fair. I think that's the right call.
Yeah,
Ron
I would
Swanson's
roll with
an
that.
An excellent character. But it's a very, very good bracket. Completely shifting gears, which we usually do away from sports things, but now back into sports things. Talked about Sammy Watkins ad nauseum. It looks like he's going to carry his full cap hit this year, free up $5 million for the Chiefs, and then if he hits those incentives, it looks like it will flow into 2021, which is a little bit surprising in terms of Brett Veach contract structures. However, when you acknowledge the fact that those are literally and figuratively not likely to be earned by Sammy Watkins, there might be no money in 2021.
Mm-hmm.
But Rudy, I hear your microphone is on, and also I'm going to sneeze.
Yeah.
So you go ahead and you fire off some takes while I sneeze off mic.
Yeah, I was just going to say half of them are contingent on the Chiefs getting to the Super Bowl. And so if the Chiefs get to the Super Bowl, if you have to go ahead and just give Sammy Watkins or you know that cap hit is an extra couple million next year, I'll trade $2 million in cap hit for a Super Bowl appearance.
100%. None of that is even questionable. the one thing there, so some of those are just about playoff berths. And then there are three, though, that Mike, this is, we're back in the freaking weeds again on this, and I don't really want to get back in the weeds, but Mike Garofolo tweeted about these incentives being AFC champ, and then Spotrac lists them as AFC championship win, and one of his is AFC championship win, but I don't know, I wouldn't have just said Super Bowl appearance. I don't know. I think you're right, though. I think those AFC championship ones are contingent on making the Super Bowl or yes. winning the AFC championship game. But if we could just listen, hey, reporters with lots of information in tweets, could you please, for the love of God in heaven, either just write up a quick blog post or just screenshot your notes app? We need more characters than this. I need more characters, Mike Garofolo.
And there's only one of them that doesn't come with regular season success as well. So honestly, they could even win the AFC Championship game. If Sammy Watkins, he will get $1.25 million just for winning. But if he doesn't have 65 catches or 800 yards, then the other two he can't even get. And that even goes the same with the playoff berth. So I mean, he has to really just stay healthy. If he stays healthy, in theory, he will hit these numbers. No guarantee, just because the Chiefs' offenses, there's a lot of guys and they spread it out pretty well.
Oh yeah.
Tyreek and Kelce are going to be the focal points. And Mecole Hardman, I expect to have a much bigger role this year because the impact that he had last year in such a short amount of snaps was that highlight. It there are guys who are fast, and Sammy Watkins is incredibly fast, but like every now and then I'll see that touchdown he had against the Titans in the regular season where Mecole Hardman went from 0 to 100 and half a step. And it is there were two guys on each side of him who probably, if it's anybody else, they make the tackle. But because he's just too fast, like he just sped off for a touchdown. And it just, every time I watch that, it's not Tyreek Hill mind blowing because of, he doesn't have that side to side quickness that Tyreek does. But that top end speed is unbelievable.
While you were talking, this entire show I've been fidgeting with a little kind of like, you know, sticky hands you used to get out of a vending machine.
Yeah, I do.
You get slap on the wall.
Yeah, it took me a little.
I have a little sort of rubber figurine kind of thing that feels a little bit like a sticky hand, but it's a tiny little bunny rabbit. And it's like dirty at this point because I've had it for a while, and it's just a thing that whenever I'm doing the show from home, as most people are doing now, and I'm a fidgety person regardless, not necessarily like in my chair, but like with my hands, and it's worse here, and I'm not usually typing or anything or whatever, so for some reason at home I've been fidgeting with things more. The little rabbit, while you were talking, Rudy, I just thought, I wonder if this would stick to the ceiling if I threw it, and I did, and it did. And now it's hanging on at, like, this weird half angle. And honestly, I can't believe it's stuck on the first try because the bottom is like a suction cup, but it's not on that. It's just the side of it. I say all this because eventually it's going to fall down and hit me in the head once I forget that it's up there. And I want to be able to announce that moment on the radio whenever it inevitably happens.
I pray that this happens while you're in the middle of a very good point.
I do, too. Now, the problem there is I would have to have a good point for that to disrupt one. You mentioned with Watkins, like Watkins is absolutely human being fast.
Yeah, he
is. But he's not
crazy
NFL receiver fast like Hardman is. And so, yeah, the one thing, by the way, even the AFC Championship win, which doesn't involve any specific stats, does say that he would need to play 50% of the snaps in that game. I think at all that the Chiefs would do anything in terms of like,
yeah,
oh, he's at half the snaps and we're up by 10. Let's get him up. I don't think any of that's happening. But if he gets hurt in the game, by the way, what a brutal call that would, like what a brutal moment that would be.
Mm-hmm.
Or if he's not active in it, or like you said, I really think that the Mecole Hardman is going to have a very nice year this season. So maybe even that one, all of them are based on the stats for Watkins outside of those $9 million that are going to be there against the cap. The play time and touchdowns and catches and yards and postseason success, all of those are certainly up in the air. This bunny.
Yeah, and if Sammy stays healthy, he's going to get plenty of chances because this team is just, they're going to roll. like they're going to roll out with those guys a lot. Like I think this team is going to be at its best when Sammy, McColl, and Tyreek are all out there, and I expect those three to be out there the vast majority of the time. Now they'll do some stuff, and you'll see DeMarcus Robinson obviously come in, and you'll see Byron Pringle come in, but like that is going to be your main three wide receiver group. And so like if Sammy stays healthy, he's going to get the opportunity to reach those numbers. It's just, you know, whether or not he stays healthy is a big question.
And it's been a question throughout his career, which is one of the reasons I think these incentives are good for the Chiefs. I'm still not in love with that, with the cap number for this year, because if you said, is Sammy Watkins worth, strictly we're going in cap space for this year now, is he worth the difference between $7 million dead and maybe 17, 16 or 17 active? I would probably just cut him for $10 million. I feel like we kind of did that already leading up to this point. But the Chiefs decided that that isn't what they'll do, and I just have to kind of shrug at that. So,
yeah, I think
let's take a break. I promise.
Whoop.
Go ahead.
The delay
is worse today, and I don't know why.
Sometimes it's just worse than other days. I've done enough of these remotes to know that just sometimes there's barely a delay, and sometimes there's a very long delay. But I think that this was the best deal the Chiefs could get with Sammy. And they obviously, I think in their mind, I don't know, just based off how little money they're saving compared to what we all thought, I don't know if they ever really considered moving on from him. I think they were going to roll with him. I think there had to be a restructuring, of course, but I think they were going to do whatever it took to get that restructured and roll with him for one more year and try to go get, you know, two in a row here.
Yeah, if you would have given the money at the beginning of the free agency market, I'm not sure where I would have spent it. But we are talking about $9 million in cap space plus the incentives to keep him on the team right now. Again, not new money, because that $7 million that would have been dead if they would have cut him, it had already been paid out. It's just prorated. So you can do that for what you will in terms of value, but I don't know. I think it's pretty interesting. And again, I'm not sure that a $9 million investment for your theoretically number three pass catcher is a bad thing. Because I'm obviously putting Hill and Kelsey ahead of him in that category, number two receiver, I suppose. I'm not mad at it. And, you know, Watkins and DeMarcus Robinson for a total of $10 million against the cap, that sounds wonderful. Both of them and Tyreek Hill for $27 million against the cap, that's all still good. It's just, it's not exactly what I expected them to end up freeing up, which is one of the reasons that I expected this slightly inflated number to include the incentive protections there, and because that doesn't appear to be the case, it's a little bit surprising. Also surprising the fact that Sticky Rabbit is still on the ceiling. That'll be an interesting liner out of context in a while. We'll see if it falls off during the break.
This is Almost Entirely Sports with Joshua Briscoe.
You know what? I'm not going to even say that sentence because I don't want that liner to exist.
Coward!
I'm finally learning.
On Sports Radio 810 WHB.
I really don't understand the physics of how this little sticky rabbit thing is stuck to my ceiling, but it is still there. And it looks pretty solid. First throw. Got it in one. I told you we'd talk about the other thing the Chiefs did today. I promised that several times. I'll do it again now. And actually follow through on it before I talk to Mick Schaefer of 41 Action News. The Kansas City Chiefs signed tight end Ricky Seals-Jones this evening. A guy who makes a lot of sense as a late signing possible tight end too, but also you could see this not working out in a way that I don't have his contract information yet. I'll be interested to see what it's for and what's guaranteed, because his sort of inability to stick anywhere, unlike the rabbit on my ceiling, I really didn't mean to get to that point again, has been a little bit troubling. But the specifics of his traits make a lot of sense. So the Chiefs signed Ricky Seals Jr. Ricky Seals Jones. I don't really want to call him Jr. He spent 2 years in Arizona as an undrafted free agent. He was at Texas A&M, had injury issues his junior year, came out after his junior year, and then still went undrafted instead of going back for his senior season. He was a receiver at A&M. That might be my favorite thing as far as, like, why this fit makes sense. He's big, and he also wasn't all that fast for a receiver. At the combine he ran, I had this somewhere, he ran a 4.69, which is pretty nice. And not horrible for a tight end, but not the speed that you want from a NFL wide receiver. So seeing him in this system will be really interesting to me, because just having a big physical tight end that played receiver but also had some pretty good pass blocking grades from the Pro Football Focus Chiefs account that tweeted that after he signed. That combination of him being out there on passing downs, and which, you know, for me would be first down, second down, third down, and fourth down, having him out there to be a receiving threat and also a guy who could competently pass block, I'm totally good with that, and I'd rather have that shot. I'd rather try that experiment than I would run back another year of Blake Bell or rely on Deion Yelder as your only guy there, or, sorry, Rudy, John Lovett, or even Nick Kizer.
How dare you?
Both on the roster right now. I'm sorry. I called them earlier. I called them both projects.
I don't think John Lovett's a project. I think we know what he is.
He's a fully formed. Yeah, he's Travis Kelce is what he is. It's basically what.
That far, but you know, you said it, not
George
me.
George Kittle.
Okay, I'm thinking old school good. Chris Cooley.
Oh, wow, that's right. Good. Look, if Travis Kelce gets hurt, the Chiefs are in tremendous trouble. Because unless George Kittle's your tight end too, that's gonna be the case regardless if Travis Kelce gets hurt. However, this makes all the sense in the world for, like, hey, Andy, watch some of this dude's tape. You can make this work? Cool. I'm going to go get him. It totally checks out as somebody you would like to see as a tertiary option, not even a secondary option in the Chiefs offense. But, you know, there are some of those infuriating plays drawn up for Blake Bell. Or if everything else breaks down, he's going to be a hard dude to cover for the most part. And I'm perfectly willing to see that exaggerated to its most ridiculous extent whenever everyone else around him is like an all-pro talent. Maybe he shows up in a couple places and Mahomes hits him. I'm cool with it. Mick Schaefer is next.